Hi, everybody. David Guzik here. I hope you can join us for today's YouTube live chat question and answer time. It's a beautiful day here in Santa Barbara. Actually, as I look outside the window, it's not all that beautiful. It's a little bit overcast, a little bit misty last night, but I'm pleased here on this Thursday afternoon to join and happy to field questions from any of the people who can tune in. I hope you subscribe to the YouTube channel. And those who can like the videos as we do them, it always helps with recognition and getting it spread a little bit broader. I'm doing it on this Tuesday here on the last week of May. It looks probable to me that I won't be able to do one of these live YouTube chats next week. But if I can, I will. I'm not going to be on site. I'm going to be out of town. And if I can do it even from a remote location, which I've done once before, I'll do it again this very next week. Other than that, I'll get back to it when I'm back at home and able to sit here in my home office and do some of this YouTube video. Before we take any questions while people are typing them in and listing them on the chat window, I did just want to take a little bit of time and talk to you about just what I've been reading in the Bible lately for myself. And lately, I've been spending a lot of time in the book of Isaiah. And wow, what an amazing book, especially I've been reading in the chapters having to do in the 40s. In this section where God challenges the idols of Israel and exposes kind of the folly, dare I even say it, the stupidity of idol worship, what shocking sections. I mean, shocking in the very best way. It's shocking to me how confrontational and even mocking God is against the practice of idol worship. And it just reminds me that, look, there's some place, as Christians, of course, everything we do, we want to be done in love. But there's a place for exposing the absurdity of the things in this world and the folly of rejecting God and going our own way. You know, that's what it says, isn't it? In it's the fool who said in his heart that there is no God. And there's a place. Look, we don't want to go around. Our main role as Christians, the dominant note is not to be mockery. It's not to be, you know, kind of laughing at the idolatry of the nations. But I will tell you this, there is a place for it from time to time. And you see it so powerfully there in the book of Isaiah. Maybe if I can find it quickly in the Bible that's in front of me, I can just read to you some of these sections from Isaiah, starting chapter 42 and chapter 43, where he just says, he talks about the idolatry that they have and the, well, here it is, Isaiah chapter 44, the blacksmith with tongs works one in the coals, fashions it with hammers, and works it out with the strength of his arms. Even so, he's hungry and his strength fails. He drinks and no water is faint. In other words, he's getting exhausted making his own idols. And then verse 13, the craftsman stretches out his rule and marks it out with chalk. He fashions it with a plane. He marks it out with a compass. He makes it like the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house. And then it goes on to say how he takes part of the wood and he burns it and cooks a meal on it. And he takes part of the meal and he uses it to make an idol that he worships. And again, it's just pointing out in such a clever and I'd say even beautiful way, the absurdity of worshiping anything other than the true God. So I just say that section in the scriptures, it just reminded me that, yes, we never want the dominant note of us as believers. We never want that dominant note to be the idea of mockery. But there is a place, time and again, from time to time, of pointing out the absurdity of worshiping anything other than the true God. All right, I'm looking over the chat window right now. Oakley fan saying, fasting in the biblical sense versus Ramadan. What is your opinion of that practice? Well, look, I'm not an expert on the fasting practices of Ramadan. To my knowledge, this is what they do, is Muslims during Ramadan, they abstain from food or drink during all daylight hours. And there comes a time during the day, I don't know exactly when it happens, but there comes a time during the day where they the sun has set adequately and they mark that the day has ended, and then they kind of feast it up during night. You know, that's not really the biblical idea of fasting. First of all, in fasting, biblically, we really don't have the idea of abstaining from water, although it seems that Moses, it's marked, had this absolute miraculous fast where he abstained from water for some days. But normally, biblical fasting, we're talking about abstaining from caloric intake. It's not just solid food. I'll be straight with you. A lot of people, when they talk about fasting in the Bible, they talk about things that aren't really fasting. They may be forms of self-denial, and that's good. So, for example, abstaining from sweets or sugar, that is an admirable and probably healthy form of self-denial, but it's not really fasting. Fasting in the biblical sense is abstaining from caloric intake. You're not consuming any calories. There are some people who go on liquid diets, and they call that fasting. Again, perhaps it is an admirable form of self-denial, but it's not really fasting. So fasting is a term we reserve in the scriptures for abstaining from caloric intake. It doesn't generally include not drinking water because water has no caloric intake, but again, abstaining from anything that would have calories. So I think there's a distinction in the way that the practice works out. But let me say this. The other thing that I have to plead a little bit of ignorance on is I'm afraid I don't really know the theology behind fasting in the Muslim practice and during Ramadan. I don't know if it's a self-righteousness thing. I don't know if it's an earning your way before God, but this is what we need to remember about the Christian practice of fasting. It is not done to twist God's arm. It's not done to get a reluctant God to do what you want him to do. Fasting is practiced to carry out the practice of getting our heart in alignment with God's heart. It's a way of expressing the depth of our concern to God. Listen, many of us have had some kind of experience. Parents know this. Parents know what it's like to have your child be sick, and you are so worried over your child's sickness that you can't eat. You're so consumed with the problem. It's a way of presenting our need or our problem before God in those terms, saying, God, this need, this thing is so important to me that I can't even eat about it. Seeking you is of greater priority than eating. Really, in a sense, that's what fasting is all about. It's a way of declaring to God, seeking you is more important to me for this day, these days, this period of time than the food I eat. Fasting is actually a neglected practice among Christians, and Christians need to fast more and more, I believe. Something that the Lord challenges me on specifically. And so I would hope that this is something that I myself, but everybody can do in a greater extent. Maybe, and I'll just throw this out as a thought, maybe it's a bit to our shame that the Muslim world is more concerned about fasting than the Christian world. Not that we should do it for their same reasons or according to their same practice or according to their same theology, but it is a little bit revealing that Christians seem rather unconcerned about fasting, yet it remains a high priority in the Muslim world. Comment from Oneism, how we should tell if we're fasting in the strength of the Lord or fasting in our own strength of flesh or mind. Well, that is a great question, a great comment. And I would just add this to the idea that we don't fast in the Christian world merely for the health benefits. Now, there's a lot of exciting studies out and more that come out that tell us of the health benefits of fasting. And actually, it's becoming something of a trend for people to do this. I've heard that there's fasting apps that you can get. And I'm not sure exactly how an app can help you fast, but apparently so. Maybe it gives some encouragement or a little timer or something like that. I don't know what it does, but there's fasting apps. people are coming into the recognition more and more that fasting has real health benefits, and we recognize that, and we should be happy about that. However, the Christian does not primarily fast for the health benefits, but rather for the spiritual benefit. And there is great spiritual benefit in the denial of the flesh and the seeking after God. It's a way for us to confront our own self and put ourself, our body, in the place where it belongs. I know it's a little bit under debate among Christians, but if we do want to speak about the human self being in a tripart thing of body, soul, and spirit, fasting is one way that we can put the body in its proper place under the soul and under the spirit, so that we demonstrate we're not ruled by our bodily appetites, but actually we're walking in the spirit and not according just to bodily appetites. All right. A Witness for Jesus asks, thank you for your question. Glad you're interacting. Can you give me a quick review of the 5 points of Calvinism? Which aspects do you agree and disagree with Tulip theology? Witness for Jesus, I don't mean to disappoint, but the answer to that question is, frankly, no, I can't give you a quick review on the 5 points of Calvinism. And I'll tell you this, that when I engage people over the issue of Calvinism or Reformed theology, and just to be clear, I'm not Calvinistic. I don't consider myself Reformed, although by the same token, I do not consider myself anti-Reformed. I'm not on a crusade, so to speak, to, you know, refute Reformed theology in the sense. There's a lot in Reformed theology that I appreciate, and there are many people in the Reformed world that I've benefited from. However, I don't consider myself a five-point Calvinist by any means, nor do I consider myself Reformed in my theology. And the tulip that A Witness for Christ refers to is that classic formulation of Calvinistic or Reformed theology that came about after Calvin's death, tulip being an acronym standing for total depravity, unconditional election is the, you don't embarrass yourself on live YouTube video here, David. Total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and the perseverance of the saints. Those five aspects. And, you know, look, Witness for Christ, I don't mean to imply that your question is invalid. Maybe I could take a whole video and talk about that, but let me say this. When I talk with people about the issue of Reformed theology, instead of dealing with it at the point of the 5 points of TULIP, I approach it from the standpoint of, does regeneration come before faith? To me, that's the critical issue. Are we born again before we believe? Or do we believe and we're born again? Now, I need to clarify something, because the Reformed position is that we are born again first and then we believe. I believe that the scriptures don't speak in that terminology, don't speak in that manner. And again, another time when I develop this in greater detail, by the way, there's recordings on enduringword.com where I deal with this question specifically. You can email me or leave a comment and I'll get the specific recording to you, or email you my notes on this. Again, you could just leave a contact thing in the chat and I can get back to you on it, or leave a comment on the video later. But look, here's my specific point. Absolutely, positively, a prior work must be done in the heart of any lost man or woman before they can believe. What I would simply agree with, and I disagree with this because I believe it's what the Bible teaches, I disagree that that prior work is regeneration. And there's a lot of reasons why I believe that, and I could go into it in greater depth. So is a prior work of God necessary in the heart of any lost man or woman before they can believe? Absolutely, positively, that's clear scripturally. But that prior work happens, a person believes, then they're born again. That is the order of salvation, as I would describe it. Again, I got a lot of resources on this on enduringword.com. If you leave some kind of contact information in the chat window, or as a comment on my YouTube channel, I'll get that information to you because it might be of value to you. Let me go on. Alex Fuentes. Alex, you're saying, would I comment on Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, as it regards the law that is in their hearts? Well, let me turn to that passage. Romans chapter 2, And specifically, what Alex is speaking about is verses 14 and 15, where it talks about the law in our hearts and it being as opposed to the law, Mosaic. Again, Alex, thank you for your question. The law that they do not have. Is Paul referring back to chapter 1 and the natural moral law? This is what it says in Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. It says this, "For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do the things contained in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of law being written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves, their thoughts accusing or else excusing them." Listen, Alex, I think you're putting your finger on something that's very important in the whole flow of the book of Romans there in the early chapters, that Paul wants to make it clear that God has revealed himself to mankind. Number one, primarily, we would agree, God has revealed himself to mankind in and through his word. That is the greatest revelation of God. The person and work of Jesus Christ are communicated to us through God's word is revelation. So we have that. Jesus revealed to us in and through the word. But that's not the only way that God reveals himself. We also see from Romans chapters 1 and 2 that God reveals himself in creation. And here, verses 14 and 15 refer to how God reveals himself in conscience. These are two. Now, creation and conscience are not equal to God's revelation of himself in and through his word. And again, when we talk about God revealing himself in his word, we do not detach that from the person of Jesus Christ. It is his word that reveals to us the person and work of Jesus Christ. In any regard, God reveals himself most perfectly, most completely, most interactively in and through his word, but he also has a revelation of himself in creation and in conscience. And Alex, I think that's what he's speaking about there, where it's the law written in their hearts, in some sense, conscience. Now, we know that conscience can be twisted. Conscience can be trained in either good ways or bad ways. Conscience can be burned over as if it were seared with a hot iron. We know that conscience is not a perfect revelation, but it is a revelation nonetheless. So, Alex, I hope that helps you there. I think he is referring back to this idea of some kind of natural moral law, something of the conscience that's written on the heart of every human being. Unism is asking the idea again of, is there more power in individual group faster? Listen, I think anytime more of God's people come together in prayer, in seeking God, in worship, in fasting, I think there's more power in that. Matter of fact, I would almost say that there's an exponential power in that. So if the power of one person fasting has its own power, the power of two people fasting might be, and I know I'm just making an analogy here, it might be times 10. Three people fasting might be that power times 100. I believe there's some kind of, I can't give you the exact arithmetic on that, but I believe there's some sort of exponential aspect to the power of God's people coming together in fasting on a larger scale. Brent sends in a question. He says, David, maybe that's not a question, but a comment. Brent says, David, I don't have a question, but your commentaries have really helped me understand the scripture so much more and helped me improve my walk with God. Thank you so much for your ministry. Well, Brent, thank you for that very kind comment. Listen, of course, I love hearing about how God uses the Bible commentary. It's something so far beyond what I ever expected. You know, I never set out to write Bible commentary. It happened almost accidentally that I found out that what I prepared for myself as teaching notes was helpful for other people as Bible commentary. You can imagine how pleased I am that God uses it. And let me tell you something. If you want to know more about the work of Enduring Word and my Bible commentary and my online work, on this very YouTube channel, there's a great little video that we posted called The Story of Enduring Word. We have it in a 4-minute version and we have it in a less than 2-minute version. Go ahead, splurge a little bit, spend the 4 minutes, watch the longer version, The Story of Enduring Word, and I think it'll tell you in a comprehensive way what God is doing. I hope you do that. I hope you subscribe to our YouTube channel and that you click the bell to get notifications about what's going on. And I'm really grateful for the people who like this video as it's going on. Thank you for doing that. And I appreciate that so much. Witness for Jesus says, please send me your notes. I'd love to read them in more detail. My position is similar to Norman Geisler's Chosen But Free. Listen, Witness for Jesus, let me tell you something. I really appreciate Norman Geisler's book, Chosen But Free. And I like that you say you love Calvinists, though. Hey, I do too. And I'm grateful for some of the work that God's done in and through our Calvinistic or Reformed brethren. There's a rich heritage there and scholarship that we can learn from. But look, I'll give you my basic approach when it comes to systems of theology. I don't subscribe fully to any system of theology. I think that to the best of our ability, we should just seek to have a biblical theology. Now, look, I'll admit that those who do subscribe to systems of theology, whether it be Reformed or Arminian or something in between, that statement I meant, I fully recognize it drives them crazy because our Reformed brethren earnestly believe that their system of theology is biblical theology. But look, I just say this. I want to stay close to my Bible and not feel like I have to try to mold a passage of scripture into a particular pattern to fit my theology. So look, I've had people come to my church and think I'm Reformed because I'm preaching on a passage that emphasizes the election of God. And let me tell you, if the text talks about the election of God, I'm going to preach it and people are going to see that I believe in the election of God. There's other people who have come to our church and been convinced I'm an Arminian because I'm teaching from a passage that speaks about the responsibility of man and that man has a real choice about his eternal destiny. I stay away from the term free will because I think it can be rightly argued that our will is not free, that our will is bound by various things, and I won't get all into that. But without using the term free will, I do believe without hesitation that mankind, men and women, have a real choice about their eternal destiny. And so if somebody's hearing me preach about that, they're going to think I'm an Arminian. And to me, it doesn't really matter too much. I want to the best of my ability, and we're all imperfect on this, but to the best of my ability, I want to let the scriptures speak for themselves. So that's what I'll keep endeavoring to do. And a Witness for Jesus, I'll be happy to send you those notes. And I'll look on the website, again, enduringword.com. Tons of audio and video resources there. I'll try to look for the message that I did talking about Reformed theology because it's a message that I've done at a few different pastors' conferences, mostly workshops, where I'll speak about Reformed theology. Again, in a way, I'm trying to lay out, look, I'm not on a crusade against Reformed theology, but at the same time, I don't mind drawing the distinction between what I believe and what I believe the Bible teaches and certain aspects of Reformed theology. But I approach it not primarily through the 5 points, the tulip argument or formulation, but more so from that very basic question, does faith come before being born again, or are we born again first and then we believe? I believe that's a better place to approach the question from. Well, I think I'm going to end it pretty much here. Again, next week, folks, I don't know that I'll post something next week because I'm going to be traveling. And if it works for me to post something while I'm out and about, I'll do it. If not, then we'll just have to wait a week and I'll post these whenever I can. I am really pleased that you could. I'm so pleased for the people who subscribe to our YouTube channel. I'm pleased for the people who like the videos while they're playing, add their likes to it. I'm very pleased for the people who click the notification button. And again, visit the website, enduringword.com. Lots of Bible resources there. And finally, I do want to say, I'm grateful for the people who support the work of Enduring Word. Brent, you said how much the commentaries helped you. Listen, it's because people are kind enough to support that work and keep those things online and support the effort to keep improving them, which I'm doing hopefully all the time.